On today's episode of The Poolside Genius, we take a look at recruiting differences between different divisions, facilities, and even Joe Moorhead. Next, we look at what college coaches look for in student athletes. Some of it may surprise you. Khalil Tate and college players picking coaching hires is a big topic today, and we dive into it. And lastly, we take a look at the Big Ten Media Day update, Harbs and scripted answers, Jim turning over a new offensive leaf, and Nebraska head coach Scott Frost and his perceived confidence. All that and more coming today. This is also a reminder to download the Anchor app so that you can call in and we will answer your questions live on the podcast and you'll be able to hear your own voice. So take that opportunity to download the Anchor podcast and send us a message and we will definitely respond to you on air. Enjoy the show.
This is Poolside Genius, where we always make a splash.
We're back with our One Foot In segment with reoccurring guest Steve Heck, wide receiver coach from the Kutztown University. Today we want to take a look at different types of recruiting along the lines of Division III, Division II, and Division I AA or Division I. Division III, I obviously went through that process. Steve, you went through that process as well. What does that really entail in terms of what they're looking for?
The Division III coaches have a tougher job because their recruiting process is really, everybody says they recruit year-round, but the Division III coaches, they've got to bring in more volume of players, i.e., 60 a class plus maybe, whereas a Division II school may bring in, depending on their roster size and scholarship availability, on a class anywhere from 20 to 40. Obviously, the scholarship schools, FBF, FBS, FCS level, their classes are a little smaller. So the Division III level, much wider net that they cast out. And the admissions departments at a lot of these schools, the football program serves as a de facto admissions department, meaning, each one of these student athletes that they recruit is a nice chunk of change for the admissions department. If you get 60 kids paying, let's say $40,000 to go there, there's a reason why some of these schools have added football recently. Alvernia, for example.
Well, yeah, that was a big thing that I know Football Scoops talked about, was that Division III football is a huge moneymaker for the schools. And, $40,000, I think, in a lot of those D3 schools, that's
low.
Way low.
Yeah,
I mean, I know,
right.
I think Muhlenberg's probably up to like 60, 65 now. And, yeah, I know that I believe we were one of the biggest classes up until that point at Muhlenberg with like 50 or so kids. And then, but after about a couple weeks, during camp, you're losing maybe 10 kids or so every year.
And the Division III schools generally don't have a roster size, so they could roster anywhere from 100 to 150, or if you're Mount Union, an unlimited amount of guys, just based on how many helmets you have and what your facilities are. Division II, for us, for example, we do have a roster limit, which is a surprise for some people. Our roster limit hovers between 87 and 90, and that's a conference rule. So we will go into camp with a smaller number than a Division III school will, and have to get down to that number. So we can't over-recruit. We can't just completely bring in an absurd amount of people, and then have to. We don't want to cut 30 kids to get down to our roster size.
Now, I just was wondering, is this a possibility that, say, you bring in some guys to be student coaches for a year, but then they end up joining the team later on after they've gained some strength and been around the program? Would that be a legal thing in terms of the NCAA rules? Has anybody done that?
Usually it happens the other way. Usually the guys begin as players and they discover, and I've had several of them that begin their careers in college and college athletics as a player, and they discover either they really want to get into coaching, or they discover the only way I can probably hang around here is to become a part of the staff as a student assistant. my current assistant receivers coach now was on the team his first year here. He transferred from Notre Dame College, not Notre Dame University. He transferred from NDC to Kutztown and wasn't as competitive as he thought he would be, and now he's currently an assistant receivers coach.
And do you think, you know, just an aside here, does that really help prepare these guys for a career in coaching, maybe better than a full 4 years of playing?
It does. It has to, because, you know, I've got guys right now that, because you're building your resume, you know, you're getting experience, you're helping run drills, you're evaluating players, you're helping recruit. And the biggest thing is you're gaining contacts, you're networking, you're going to clinics. And you have a drill book that you can take to an interview. You have a playbook that you can take to an interview. If you played 5 years as a college student athlete and then you want to get into coaching, your best avenue would be to get into scholastic coaching. It's the kind of the way I did it. If you played 1 or 2 years in the college ranks and then you became a student assistant or an intern, per se, in the college ranks, and then kind of gravitated towards a GA role, well, your chances of becoming a college coach are up pretty high compared to if you just were a player. Now you're just relying on contacts as a player.
Now, do you think that any of the D3 or D2 schools end up going all out, like the Division I schools? You see, like, the big Twitter pictures with these guys, you know, in the Michigan gear, or, you know, sending them birthday you know, any kind of ridiculousness like that going on at the lower levels, do you think?
Well, there's rules, you know. The NCAA is now had to regulate these things. For example, one of the rules that I'm studying for my recruiting test, that we have to take a yearly recruiting test on NCAA rules and regulations. And one of the questions is, you bring a student athlete into your stadium and you put his image and likeness up on the scoreboard. Is this legal? And then they have a whole list of things. And the answer is, it's only legal if it's not visible to the public and the stadium is empty. So the NCAA is very conscious of the recruiting techniques that are being used by all these teams at all the levels, our level, lower levels. The thing that happened about 4 years ago that's now become very popular, and it's driven by social media, is jerseys, wearing the jersey of the place that you visited. That didn't exist a few years ago. Now, everybody that goes on a visit, they have to wear the jersey and their jersey number, and they get a photo taken. And, you know, and obviously social media drives that whole interest. The kid wants to go to the, they don't care what the science building looks like. When am I getting my picture so I can post it on my Twitter account of me in a tight jersey wearing blue jeans and a baseball hat?
Do they care, you know, at the D2 level, D3 level, do they make a big deal about the facilities at all?
You know, I think that most of them understand it's still a facilities race. Division III's got some really nice facilities. Some of these places have spent a lot of money on facilities. Seems to be Division II is, because a lot of these are state schools and the money's not flowing and the donors maybe aren't, you know, you went to a school, Muhlenberg, for example, Franklin Marshall, some of these other schools, Remo went to Albright. Some of the alums, you know, they become lawyers, doctors, governors, like, for example, LVC. A lot of the state schools, the people graduated, they become teachers and jobs that maybe didn't have the type of revenue. So the facilities at our level sometimes maybe are still, we're still a little playing catch up. But I think what really matters to most kids that I've discovered is how successful is the program. You'd be surprised how these kids research the program. They want to know, what has your record been the last 3 or 4 years? And that speaks to society today. Kids, it's harder to sell a kid on a losing program than it is on just an average locker room.
No, and that's interesting. I mean, I even know, I remember, I think when I was going to Muhlenberg for my recruiting, they would say, oh, where were you getting recruited? Where did you visit? I said, oh, they didn't show you their locker rooms, did they? You know, and they go through that. It was always funny. Now, I was just recently back at Muhlenberg a few months ago, and my buddies and I kind of walked down to the locker room. Man, they have like leather chairs and like they got a big TV screen in there. I was like, man, where was that when we went there? But I know, and this is another thing you talk about the record. I know Coach Donnelly, you know, rest his soul, would talk about in the recruiting pitch, he would say, you know, your son or daughter, if they go, or well, actually your son, if they go to a different school and they're telling you, wow, your son's going to start right away, is that really where your son wants to be? You know, is that really going to be a good program? Are they going to win? And that always kind of stuck with me as, you know, a big selling point where, you know, hey, you know, if you're not going to play right away, that's a good thing. In some cases, you're going to get that chance to develop and be a part of a winning program.
Yeah, the struggling teams will sell opportunity. Teams that have struggled to win games, you have a chance to come in and play right away. That's their recruiting pitch. And getting back to the facilities discussion, another thing to think about that we've discussed as a staff, if a kid comes to our facility, looks at the locker room, turns his nose up, he's probably not a KU guy. And our guys that are on the roster now, one of the things that we will ask them during the recruiting process as they get to know our recruits is he a KU guy? Meaning, if he's all about the facilities and a chrome helmet and a Tech Fit 3 jerseys, and probably not going to be a great fit.
Absolutely. Now, with the D1 type guys, you know, their arms race, so to speak, you know, the facilities there, it seems like every single coach that you talk to, I know there was a recent Rich Scarcello interview with James Franklin, and he talked about the Penn State facilities being less than stellar. They hadn't done anything for 20 years. Like, that's a big deal. You know, any other place that a coach takes over, they're seemingly saying, man, we got to get these facilities up to date. You know, Brahm, you know, was talking about that at Purdue. You see it everywhere where everybody says, look, we need to build those facilities. It doesn't seem to really make the difference. It doesn't really seem to move the needle. But those coaches sure as heck want that. You know, you look at PJ Fleck even, you know, in Minnesota just spent a boatload of money to improve their facilities and, you know, put inspirational historical figures up on the wall and everything. You know, it doesn't really move the needle.
Well, it's also their environment. If you work somewhere and spent all your time there, you would want a better facility for you selfishly. So that's part of what drives it. And I think most coaches want better facilities, and they beat the drum kind of convincing the administration that, hey, look, we could really be good if you guys would only spend some money and raise some money to give us a better locker room and to give us this. And the reality is, last time I checked, you know, USC, when Pete Carroll was there, pretty much average to below average facilities. They did pretty well. Miami has been known to have really run-of-the-mill facilities in the history of college football. They've done very well. And there are also some places that have spent a lot of money, and the results haven't yet met up with the amount of outlay of the revenue. So is it important? It's more important to the coaches. The kids it's important to, but I think the coaches probably are going to be there more than the kids are.
Yeah, and I wanted to, you know, revisit something from maybe a couple weeks ago. The AD from Oklahoma State comes out and says, man, we should be recruiting a lot better. Our rankings are way down, you know, and Coach Gundy and his staff, you know, they do a great job of, you know, getting those guys better, those three-star recruits, those two-star recruits, getting them better once they're on campus, and our strength program is great, but, you know, we need to be at a much higher level. And this is a pretty good program at Oklahoma State. You know, where do you fall? You know, are they just focusing on guys that they think fit their system, fit their school, fit their community that they're trying to develop, or is it that they're missing out, or they're not really getting those top tier guys? You know, is it something that's on purpose, or is it something that they're missing out?
I don't see what the AD there is referencing. I see Oklahoma State operating at a pretty high level, and the only thing you could say, the only argument you could make is at the downturn of Texas, they didn't capitalize it in terms of a slew of conference or national championships. But if it was such a great job, why did Les Miles go from Oklahoma State to LSU? You know, Oklahoma State is – Gundy is, you know, he probably wouldn't be there for this long a time had he not been an alum. You know, and I get the fact that the AD is trying to raise the bar. But I don't think Mike Gundy needs the bar raised for him by an athletic director. I think, you know, that it's maybe some bitterness about how Gundy was sniffing around the Tennessee job a bit. But I don't get it. I think Oklahoma State is operating at a level that I don't see there's a totally different gear for them to reach into.
Steve, ultimately the recruiting decisions comes down to these kids making, you know, these lifelong decisions. In regards to KU, your pool of players that you're looking for, does that sometimes get in the same pool as D1? And if so, I guess my question would be, if you had to give a message to a kid who might be looking both at D1 versus D2, what are some of the things they have to really take into account?
That's a good question. We intersect with the Division I schools generally from the Patriot League, which would be Bucknell, Lehigh, Lafayette, and to a certain degree maybe some Ivy League schools, and some mid-level FCS schools. Rarely will we intersect with Division I-A schools, except in a rare situation of a transfer, which we've had here and there. We had a transfer from UConn in 2011 that came for a year. He was coming. He was a local guy to begin with. He came, and he had 1 year of eligibility left, and he was from Lehighton, and he was a running back, and he wanted to get his graduate degree. So he had exhausted. He had his four-year degree from UConn. He came and got his master's degree at KU and played 1 year. Helped us get over the edge and helped us win a championship that year. But in terms of what to look for, you know, I think it's first education. That sounds like a cop-out answer, but the reality is, you know, we are not in a position to give a full scholarship, and a lot of schools aren't. A lot of and this is the fallacy that a lot of people don't understand. Just because schools are scholarship schools doesn't mean they're giving full scholarships. You know, you see these people put on social media, blessed to receive a scholarship from XYZ University. Well, that may be a housing grant for $500. That may be a $1,000 athletic aid scholarship. So there's a whole lot of levels of scholarship. But ultimately, it's fit and it's comfort level. And football should not be the primary reason that you're selecting a school. And when you read these articles about why kids select schools, generally, whether it's true or not, the student athlete selects a school A over school B in their mind because they feel more comfortable with the players, staff, and surroundings. And it's a feel, it's a comfort level feel on a campus. So that's why recruiting is still ultimately about people. And that's the beauty of recruiting. It's not about money necessarily. Money counts, but you can make a difference as a coach, as a recruiter, when two people are recruiting the same student athlete and one guy develops a relationship and the other guy sends a text or an email every couple weeks or a month, and then the other guy is checking in with the kid regularly, that counts, you know. And I kind of use the phrase retail recruiting. And, you know, every 4 years when there's a presidential election, they go up to New Hampshire early on. And they go to Manchester, New Hampshire, and have these debates at a place called St. Anselm, which is a school that used to be on our schedule. So retail recruiting and retail politics, which is what happens in the New Hampshire primary, is a lot different than the type of politics that happens at a place like Iowa, where they have a caucus and all these farmers are spread out coming in. Retail recruiting is one-on-one, pressing the flesh, knocking on doors, not sending a mass chain email, not having a press conference or a speech or a rally in front of 2,000 farmers. Retail recruiting is, I'm going to take you on a two-hour tour of our college campus today, and you and your parents, and it's me, and you're going to get a good feel of what we have to offer. So that's the way that, you know, for us in our position, that's the way we found a avenue to be competitive against maybe schools that have maybe better facilities and maybe more financial resources.
Do you think that at the higher levels that sometimes teams will pick an ace recruiter over a guy that can coach better, that's a better teacher in terms of technique, skill, scheme? You know, do you see that's a trade-off that they're most likely to make a lot of times?
Generally, yes, because you have to get the player. It's all about, there's guys that get coaching jobs based on their recruiting resume, not based on who they've developed, but who did they get to the school. And the theory is, let's just get the kid here. And we want to make sure we get him and not our rival. So, and it's what kind of recruiting context do you have? Who's in your, you know, what kind of high school coaches are you tight with? That's big at all the levels, but since, you know, we don't really recruit nationally. So the Division I schools that do recruit nationally, they've got to find guys that fit a geographic expertise. They need a guy that is really good in Florida. They need a guy that's really good in Atlanta. They need a guy that knows Los Angeles. They need a guy that, you know, all the, we need an Ohio guy. We need a Maryland guy. So absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, part of that, you see Leach brought in Arp Riles, you know, because of the Texas connection when they were first there at Texas Tech. You know, do you think that a guy like Joe Moorhead might have some trouble in Mississippi State, who's primarily a Northeast guy, has coached in the Northeast, has lived in the Northeast all his life? Do you think that he might have some struggles down in the SEC country?
Yeah, he could, except for I think he's smart enough to have some guys on his staff that will have some connections. I also think that, you know, you really want to root for Moorhead. And, you know, Moorhead's been very loyal to the guys that he's hired and the guys that he's asked to join the staffs that he's been to. Remember what they said about Dan Mullen when he first got down there. You know, and it's definitely going to be an adjustment for Coach Moorhead, but I think he's got enough in the bank and enough of a reputation nationally to maybe bridge some of that. And you know what he'll be doing, and he has already done? He's been to high school coaches clinics. He's been to different clinics and pressing the flesh and introducing himself and getting his guys to every key spot that he'll have to get to, not only in the Southeast, but Midwest and any area he thinks he needs to be. He spent the winter doing that. So I think he's not in a bad shape. Yeah, it's going to be a challenge, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, and you spoke about the loyalty. I remember reading an article or an interview, and he talked about how Randy Edsall, when he went to Maryland from UConn, he kind of just left most of the staff there, and you know, maybe not necessarily even in UConn, but left them without jobs and didn't take them with. You know, and that's kind of a fascinating thing, and that might have been, ideally, if he takes Joe Moorhead with him, he might have had more success at Maryland as opposed to what he ended up doing. Also, you see Scott Frost take almost the entire staff with him. You see Chad Morris take almost the entire staff with him. So, you know, maybe that's in a little bit of an indicative of their personalities as a coach.
I think you hit on it, Cody. I think Coach Moorhead and Coach Edsall probably operating on opposite ends of the paradigm. You know, and you root for Coach Moorhead. You really do.
Now, you talked about, I hate to bring this up, but Coach Edsall had a big article in The Athletic where he talks about how players should be paid, and he also talks about how there should be someone that's in charge of each NCAA sport in terms of the NCAA. Like, they should have a president in charge of football, a president in charge of basketball. And it was kind of enlightening to kind of see that idea, but do you think more bureaucracy is really the answer?
No. No, I don't, but The more of those types that you hire, the NCAA struggles right now policing itself and policing the other schools. You know, the NCAA right now probably doesn't have enough personnel to cover and really manage the infractions and the recruiting and all the things that occur at all the levels, let alone the highest levels. And they rely on the schools themselves to self-police and to be their own compliance officers. So, you know, who's going to pay for all that, though? Like, where's the money for all that bureaucracy going to come from? You know,
will they take paying the players?
Yeah,
well, exactly. That's the point. I mean,
they have the labor force that is not getting paid. Oh, again, they're getting their scholarships, and education is a great thing, but you know, some of these guys are risking, you know, their lives in some cases, risking life-altering injuries. You know, I think they deserve a little bit more.
Think about the NCAA a couple of years ago when they got slapped in this lawsuit, the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, and now they have to deal with the aftermath of all of that. And now this issue is really mushrooming.
Well, yeah, and you see how ridiculous that is, because there was a deal on the table that EA Sports would have paid so that they could still use the likenesses, and it would have been satisfactory to the players' side. But the NCAA said, no, we're not going to do it. We don't want to give any money out. And it, really, the NCAA is, it's only about its own preservation.
They got rid of the games, too. And yeah. You hear people upset. You can't get the college game anymore.
Oh my God! How much money would those games generate? How much interest in the sports did they generate? It was awesome. I miss that. There are still people that play those games from 15. There was a big article talking to Denard Robinson, the last guy on the NCAA cover, and how his life's changed since then. But it's a sad thing because kids today love video games. Well, kids, you know, for a long time have loved video games, but you're depriving them of being able to play with their favorite college players. It's just unfortunate.
You know, the interesting seesaw between this whole issue is, you know, do you pay the kids up front and then you deal with are they amateurs or not? Or do you try and find a way to pay them on the back end? I know Josh Rosen, just drafted by the Cardinals, has come up with a pretty interesting idea that he's trying to get out there. There was an article, I think it was in The Athletic.
I believe it was Yahoo.
That's right, it was. How he was mentioning that it was going to be based around kids graduating and it kind of like setting up a tier in terms of how they would get paid. And there would also be like a clearinghouse.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, anything that incentivizes people graduating, I think that's a huge positive because even if you do make it into the NFL, your career is shorter than 4 years. And, you know, granted, that's big time money, more money than I'll ever make in a year, just the league minimum. But at the end of the day, it can only last for so long. That's not going to last you a lifetime, especially with some of the habits that, you know, being a baller could, you know, bring forth. So I think especially the financial literacy and things like that, I think that's really important to get your degree and help those players really deal with and cope with being a professional. And those guys that didn't get to be a professional, they get something out of it too, because guess what? They're still in the video game.
I think you'd see a lot more guys going back to school to finish their degree if there was a financial, tangible reward besides the diploma itself. So seems like a viable idea to me.
Especially if you got guys, and I'm thinking the NBA here, where you decide to come out. Granted, the NBA, if you don't hire an agent, you can go back in. But even if you do, and luckily you can go over play overseas, but you think about guys that think they're good and they don't get drafted, and then they're out of luck. And to be able to, if that was the case, possibly go back, get their degree, that'd probably be a saving grace. The only problem is they've used up their amateurism. Welcome back, folks. We're sitting here with our good friend Steve Heck. We've been talking a lot about football in the last couple segments. One of the great things that I've had the opportunity to do is to have the chance to work with Steve as a coach in basketball. We both coach together. I think I'm very lucky to have him as a fellow coach, and we've had the opportunity to really form a strong bond, and we really work well off each other. With that in mind, Steve, I wanted to ask you a question that revolves around coaching in general. When you look at kids, whether it's at the scholastic level or at the college level, and specifically at the college level, you're going to be picking, you know, you're looking to recruit. What do you look for, or what's more important for you as a coach, talent or work ethic?
Well, work ethic is a talent. So it's, to me, talent is a pejorative word because talent is something you're kind of born with. I don't necessarily, if I was a player, I wouldn't want a coach to tell me I am talented because usually that comes with a but. Hey, you're talented, but. And that's been my experience with the word talent. So ultimately, we will recruit guys that have talent and are hard workers. So we will try not to recruit guys, if we can, who are talented. And if we know they are not a hard worker and we get that information, if we do our due diligence from talking to high school coaches, talking to as many people as we can in the process of researching these recruits, if we're recruiting a guy that's talented and not a hard worker, that's on us. And the chances of that kid finding the next year when he gets to college doesn't usually happen, you know. And I want guys that have talent, that are hardworking. But the biggest thing I would like is guys that are reliable off the field, on the field, in the classroom. That is a type of talent for me, reliability. And you hear that phrase all the time. That's the best type of ability, dependability, reliability. That's the truth. We really believe in that. And I think hard work, reliability, being a great teammate, having the idea of putting other things before yourself, that is a talent that's valuable to us and to most coaches.
Let me build off that. Do you see a difference in kids figuring out or recognizing that, you know, work ethic really does matter? Do you think there's a difference between the scholastic level and then does it click in somewhere along the line in college, or is there really no difference?
I think the guys that get to the college level that last past the first year, they adjust their first year. The guys that don't last past the first semester or year, those are guys that haven't adapted to their new environment. And I think that's the key. The hardest environment as a student athlete will be your freshman year first semester, because all your changes happen in your three domains. You have a social domain that's totally different. You have an academic domain now where you have classes. Instead of every day, you have them twice a week or three times a week. Your professors you have a different relationship with them than you would have with your teachers, in terms of, you know, your teachers are kind of on your case. The professors are a little bit more expecting you to be professional and be adult about it. The guys that last past the first semester and the second semester, once you get them past those danger zones, what I call the critical period for a student athlete, first semester, second semester, that's the heavy lifting. And that to me, that's also the funnest part and the most rewarding about being a coach. I probably didn't answer your question, but.
Now, I want to just go back a little bit. You talked about being a great teammate, you know, work ethic. What does that look like? If you're talking to Cody Bender in 2005, you know, you're coming in and, you know, or you're watching on a Friday night or on a Saturday afternoon. What does that look like to you? Because I think a lot of high school, junior high type players don't really know what those things, you know, they say, okay, I hear the word, but I don't know what that looks like.
Body language. Here's the thing. PJ Fleck, head coach at Minnesota, heard him speak one time. He will have his GAs put together a highlight tape of receivers, skilled players, running backs, receivers. He'll take every touchdown the kid scores. He'll put it on a loop. What he wants to see is who's celebrating with the kid. If a kid scores a touchdown and nobody comes over to congratulate him, Minnesota is going to scratch that kid's name off their recruiting list, because that to him is an indicator of not a great teammate. So how do your teammate, how do your other players react to you when you're successful? How do you react to them when they're successful? Do you have the ability when one of your teammates, especially at the college level, off the field, is about ready to make a bad decision? Do you have the ability to step outside of maybe your comfort zone and pull him out of a bad decision that he may make? Or are you selfish enough to say, hey, that's not my problem? The reality is it is your problem, because it could impact the whole team. So we look for body language. We look for leadership skills. I'll give you an example. I was recruiting a kid this year, a wide receiver. I went to see him play probably 6 or 7 times. There was one critical play. The team had called a timeout. The coaches came to the sideline. And I go to the games to watch kids. I don't go to watch them necessarily play. I can see that on film. I want to see how do they react to stress. I want to see how they react to their teammates. How do their coaches and teammates interact with each other? So the coach calls a timeout in a critical period, and the coach is calling a play on the sideline to everybody. And one of the guys' teammates that I was recruiting starts to go bonkers on the sideline, starts to lose it. The guy I'm recruiting grabs him, calms him down, talks to him, and gets him straightened out, because they're in a critical situation now. It's third and long, deep in the game. When I saw that kid grab a high level player, the guy he was grabbing and calming down, high level player, also a college recruited student athlete. When I saw the guy that we were targeting, when I saw him do that, I knew we had the right guy. it was beyond the and that's the stuff you won't see on the huddle tape. You won't see on the stat sheet. I had to drive, you know, an hour and a half to see this kid do that. And once I saw that, I knew we had the right guy.
So on the flip side, what kind of things, you know, just make you scratch them off the list? I mean, what when you see it, what you talk about the body language, are they like Jay Cutler out there? You know, what does that look like as well?
Well, the beauty of today's technology with social media, and the myth about me is that I'm anti-social media. Not at all. Just because I'm invisible on social media doesn't mean I'm anti-social media. As a college coach, to me, I'm an investigator, and people are leaving clues everywhere now. They're giving you evidence. It's all over social media. It's out there. All you got to do is reach out and grab it. So we'll look at the kid's Twitter account. We'll look at stuff that he posts. You know, if there's questionable things on there, for example, alcohol advertisements, bad language, disrespect towards women, that's a big no-no. You investigate them. And you talk to their youth league coaches. Sometimes talking to only their head coach is not enough, because some head coaches will not tell you the truth. You know, I had a NFL scout talk to me one time about one of my players, and it was a very difficult conversation because I had to tell the scout my opinion of the player. And the scout said, look, I appreciate your honesty because we need this information. And I think you have to be honest with people. If a high school coach, to me, doesn't give me good information about a kid, the next time I talk to him, I'm going to take that information with a grain of salt. So you have to be a good investigator. Body language is a biggie, but it's fixable. Body language is fixable. Decision-making is fixable. But if you're spending all your time and energy as a coach fixing things, when are you really developing the individual? Like, our job as coaches is to teach fundamentals and develop character and those things, but you have to start at a high enough level that you don't spend all your time as a coach putting out fires. And I've done that. We've done that. We've had to spend an inordinate amount of time putting fires out. And some schools will say, hey, we're willing to live with it. We're willing to live with a kid's talent, and we'll put those fires out.
You know, it's funny, Steve, you have the opportunity to be working both at the NCAA level, but also the scholastic level with both Bender and myself. The way I look at, we're talking about being good teammates. It starts down there. There's no doubt about it. I just fear that, you know, we get so wrapped up, especially at the scholastic level, of, you know, good sportsmanship and, you know, making sure parents are placated and, you know, even you have to placate the kids sometimes. That sometimes I think as coaches, we might lose the fact or the outlook of our job is really to teach kids how to be good teammates. Do you feel that's sometimes lost in all this other minutia that gets thrown into coaches' faces?
I do, because there's no playbook for how do you be a good teammate. And I think that it starts with ultimately that being a good teammate starts at home with the kids' parents. That's where 90% of it will start. If we can add the 10% from our athletic viewpoint, that's going to be a bonus. But generally, kids that are not great teammates, there's a reason why they're not great teammates. There's a reason why they're self-absorbed. And it's because of something that maybe is going on at home. And that's the beauty of being a college coach as opposed to a high school coach or a junior high coach. When you're a college coach, the parents are removed geographically and in time and space. They're farther away. So you wear more hats as a college coach. And that to me is a good thing, because you have more control and you have the impact is now manifested by, okay, after practice, the kid doesn't go home in college. He goes to his dorm or he goes to the facility where you can talk to him and meet him. High school, junior high, the kid goes home. You don't have access to them. So I think the jobs that scholastic level coaches do, from my experience, are doing both 10 times harder than the college coaching, simply because of the barriers that are in place. College coaches, there's less barriers. Yeah, you have less time to work with the kids fundamentally, but your access to the players as a college coach is phenomenal compared to, you know, high school parents. You're fighting this war that, okay, the parents are giving them one message. You as a coach, giving them one message. hey, when you're at college, you have a chance to win that battle, especially if the message you're getting from the parents is not necessarily the right one.
Yeah, especially if you think about, you know, at the scholastic level, those parents are still, you know, they're eyeing that scholarship, whereas at the NCAA, that's already been decided.
And the you know, 2%, 1 or 2% of those scholarships are out there, and the beauty of it is 99% of the parents think that they're going to get 2% of those scholarships, and they're a bit off skew.
Yeah, and yeah, I know you probably listened to the other episodes. Actually, I know you did. Reams and I talked about, you know, multiple sports, being a multiple sport athlete. Where do you fall as a college coach looking to recruit players?
Yeah, this is a layup. I want guys playing. I want three sport athletes if we can. Two sports for sure. We don't want specialists. We don't want guys that I only do one sport. And for the most part, when you look at our recruiting class, and just look at the wide receiver, all the guys we're bringing in are 2- and 3-sport athletes, and I will go watch them play baseball. I will go watch them play basketball, you know, for two reasons. It shows the kid I'm interested, but also it gives me another set of pieces of evidence to, you know, I make my case for, hey, this is a kid we really want. I saw him play multiple sports. I was a 3-sport athlete, not great in some sports, better in others, but I just think specialization is hurting guys with overuse injuries. And I think that kids are predetermining what their future holds at age 11 or age 9 or age 7. They're predetermining, I am going to be here. The reality is, as you morph and develop and change, you may be missing a great opportunity to become a better athlete in another sport, but you have to investigate it. And even if you don't become a better athlete and say you don't excel in another sport, playing multiple sports only helps the sport that you think is your main sport. And the data is in. It's not like a global warming debate where there's six sides of it. The data is in. Playing one sport leads to overuse injuries, burnout, and increased participation. Doesn't lead to an automatic scholarship. That's not the magic bullet for that.
Yeah, and I read a great article maybe a few months ago by Jordy Nelson, I believe it was the Players Tribune, talked about playing 4 sports, and he said, you know, if I would have picked my favorite sport, I believe it would have been basketball in high school, you know, and if I picked the sport I was best at, it probably would have been track, you know, and football wouldn't have even been on the table, you know, but he continued to play those sports, and he's now a great Packer, now he's a Raider. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, life throws you different things and you kind of evolve and change and get better at different sports. You know, it's not always the sport that you love the most, but it might be the sport that you're just the best at.
I'd just give you a quick story. Again, another guy we were recruiting, he was an AU basketball player in the junior high to JV era. And he's, in his mind, he was headed to Marquette. He was going to be the next Dwayne Wade. So he followed the AU trail. Meanwhile, he was still playing baseball and football, but basketball was his main sport. And one day, he went to his coach and said, "Hey, you know, his football coach said, I don't think I'm going to be the quarterback. I'd like to try another position." Going into his junior year, he makes this change from quarterback to wide receiver. His junior year, he's an All-State wide receiver. His senior year, he's a 2-time All-State wide receiver. And then I watched him play basketball, and he's a competent point guard on an average Central PA basketball team. He averaged 5 points a game, a couple assists, a couple of rebounds. He's not playing at Marquette, but he got himself to a position where he is a Division II scholarship athlete. But had he predetermined his future, he'd be not playing college basketball because he's not a Division III basketball player. So, lesson to kids out there. Don't predetermine when you're at 13, 14 years old that this is my future. Play all the sports you can.
Now, one thing I'm always fascinated about, and you see a lot of people on both sides of this argument, do you think that, you know, maybe the strength and conditioning portion is maybe sometimes a little overhyped? Do you think the sprinting and the run form, I mean, where do you think that balances, you know, for what's best for the player?
I think kids... It's funny because for as much time as most of these high schools invest in the off-season program, we still find kids that don't know how to squat, don't know how to clean, and don't know how to spot each other, don't know how to run, sprinting form. So, you know, one of the first things are most of the strength and conditioning coaches that I've been around, first couple days on the job, they're just thinking about safety, and they're teaching the kids how to lift. Even in 2018, you think, oh, man, there's no way. No, they don't know. Some of these kids, or they're doing things incorrectly. Again, it goes back to my earlier thesis of more isn't better. Better is better. So instead of doing a lot of stuff kind of with some flaws in it, how about cut it back, teach a little bit, teach some techniques, get kids good at things, get them confident things. Don't try to do nine things mediocre. Get good at some fundamentals. And then see, really troubleshoot where the kid is struggling, you know. And like Reams and I see guys that flat out can't run, you know. They don't, their biomechanics are not, and that you see that more at the lower levels. But you know, at the higher levels, you see guys that compensate for bad technique because they've gotten older. They compensate for bad form. And they've gotten so comfortable with it. I mean, look at golf. And all these years ago. Nowadays, the swings look similar. Years ago, in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, everybody had a different swing. But guys knew how to – they get the club head right where they needed to be on impact. You know, now all the swings kind of look similar because there's only a handful of ways that people are teaching the golf swing.
And now all these golfers are all into fitness also.
Yeah, but guys are getting hurt too.
Yeah.
You know, they're more musculature, but more guys are getting hurt. But the other thing you see is – I see it in racing too – more guys are getting hurt riding bicycles on the road than ever before. Like, you see big-time athletes, and you see, oh, he's out for 6 weeks because he got hit on the road training, riding his bike. Like, wow, you know, who knew it was that dangerous? But it's, you know, there's a lot of bad drivers out there.
Sticking with the topic of recruiting, we're going to take a look at Khalil Tate and his effect on coaches in general. Arizona was looking to replace Coach Rodriguez after he was dismissed, and they were looking at the Navy coach, Coach Ken, and Khalil Tate tweets out that, hey, I don't want Coach Ken, you know, I didn't come to Arizona to run the triple, you know, triple option. I don't have any interest in that. And then he deleted it. He said, well, hey, you know, I'm just using my platform. I'm, you know, my teammates and I didn't come here to play in the triple. And he's like, by deleting it, it got a bigger stir. And he essentially kind of hijacked the coaching hiring process from the AD, from the president. And, you know, the Arizona then said, oh, well, we want to be student-centered. We want to have students be problem solvers and be involved. You know, what kind of precedent does this set for the future of coaching and the future of college athletics?
The president actually called them disruptive problem solvers. I thought that was an incredible adjective.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. And to use, who was the NFL owner that said the inmates running the assignment? Was it Bob McNair for the Houston Texans that got crushed for...
Deservedly so.
Yeah, but it's, you know, if the players are going to have a role in selecting the coaches, to me there would be a lot of turnover, and the turnover would occur it would be biannual turnover, about every 2 years or every other half a recruiting class. Unless the team, you know, won 10 or 11 games, it would be kind of chaotic. Yeah, it gets Sumlin in the door at Arizona, but you know, Arizona probably, they got a great coach in Sumlin, probably a better fit anyway, and a great geographic fit. But just the idea of the players having really any leverage to, and these are people that allegedly have enough on their plate with 15 credits and the packed schedule that a student athlete has. So you want to add interviewing, vetting, putting a staff together, going through references and resources, absurd.
Yeah, and well, the thing is, I don't think that those players are actually doing that. You know, they're just saying, you know, what they saw on ESPN, what they saw on Twitter. Oh, well, you know, my God, that coach is never going to adjust to the talent that he has. He's just going to stick to what he does. I get it a little bit in the NFL where, you know, if you have Aaron Rodgers or you have Tom Brady or you have Peyton Manning and you are hiring a new coach, you want them to have a say because guess what? They're locked up for the next 10 years and they're your franchise quarterback and you have them there and they should have a big say. But when you look at going to college guys, like you said, but that biannual turnover, that also opens the gates for people to, you know, players to be upset about their role, to be upset about, you know, maybe they're running the ball too much or maybe they're not throwing it enough. And then they start tweeting out that they're dissatisfied, that their coach, you know, is mean, you know, whatever the case may be. Then, you know, then does everybody jump and move to fire that coach? And then the kids are in charge of finding the next coach or approving the next coach. Like you said, it's a slippery slope, and I don't know that it would result in better football. I don't know that it would result in more success as a team, and I think we'll definitely see it there in Arizona either way.
You know, the backstory behind this is you have to have the college president on board with it, and it just so happened this college president is relatively new. Not only as a educator, in fact, he came from the healthcare sector where he was this very successful healthcare CEO. And what the quote that he mentioned was, much like healthcare, it's not very
patient friendly.
Exactly. So what he was trying to say is, gee, I guess colleges aren't, you know, student athlete friendly. Yeah, I guess in terms of, you know, the whole NCAA issue with not paying, maybe in that light you could see that, but in this case, it's from an AD standpoint, you're probably gonna have to be making those new hires all the time. It's just mind-boggling.
The student athletes via the recruiting process, which in some cases will take 2-3 years, they are in effect choosing the coach. They select the coach. If anybody selects a coach, it's the top upper level, you know, Power Five. That you're picking who you want to play for. Now I get the fact that when there's a coaching change,
that just means that the players picked wrong, right? I mean, because they weren't successful.
Yeah, they didn't win enough games. Or no, sometimes the coach, they do win a lot of games, and the coach leaves. You know, and that's another issue. But
could we not just say? Let the kids out, and granted, you know, they have to sit out. I mean, this is a whole nother issue.
Yeah, and the NCAA is already investigating and dealing with transfer rules and regulations. And
but doesn't that then become what some of these high school programs are having to deal with? You know, where kids are just jumping from high school to high school in an attempt to raise their stock in terms of recruiting. And I don't think that's good at all. I don't think you're learning, you know, to be a part of a team, you know, to be a great teammate. I don't think you're learning any of the life lessons of leadership or anything. How can you be a leader when you're moving from place to place just to profit yourself and have no team concept whatsoever? I really am thinking that football or sports in general are not about that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think I read something where Gary Patterson came out, TCU head coach, who's really one of the more underrated among outsiders probably than he is among insiders. He came out and referenced the transfer regulations that are starting to become relaxed, and he said it just really teaches student athletes it's okay to quit when things don't go your way. It's okay to bail out, and there is too much of that. There is too much pushing the delete button and the erasing and starting a brand new. We were talking about video games earlier. It's too much of that. It's time to start over because I'm facing a slight bit of adversity.
You know, it's I right away think of basketball in this case. I had
LeBron James,
a kid. Yeah, well, we could get into LeBron, and you know, it's interesting. You see LeBron this whole summer coaching his son in AAU, and I'm gonna say something about AAU here. I had a kid play an AAU team for a team, and then he comes back to me. I was going to go watch him play, and he comes back with a totally different schedule for a totally different team. He wasn't playing, you know, two different teams. He actually got away from the first team because they disintegrated, because they couldn't get along or wasn't at this higher level. So yeah. It's mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, and I think that teaches a lot of the wrong things. But I want to go back to something you said about Gary Patterson. You know, isn't it a little disingenuous? Not from Gary Patterson, obviously, but from a lot of the coaches that'll leave at any moment just so that they can get a better job or get more money. Like, isn't that disingenuous to say, wow, that'll teach people to quit? Well, guess what? There are a lot of coaches that are quitting just for a better job, for more money. And again, I get it. You know, a lot of people go, move to better jobs or things that are better for their family, you know, whether that be more money, whether that be better, greater opportunity. I understand that. But, you know, it's in some ways you can't have it both ways.
Well, Gary Patterson said that, though. He's been a guy that's probably passed up a lot of other opportunities. You didn't see a lot of other guys ring that bell the way he did. So, yeah, you're right. And you know, you've got to, as a big time college football coach, you've got an earning potential, and you're just like, you have a window to strike while the iron's hot, and you're a free agent. But you know, there's a lot of chaos when a staff comes and goes, and this whole staff recruited these guys, and this staff didn't recruit them, and you're talking about, you know, when a head coach leaves one program, goes to another, it's not one guy, it's the equipment manager, it's the trainers, it's the tight ends coach, you're talking 15 to 20 guys that it impacts.
Absolutely, and obviously we're going to see that's, you know, a huge thing there. I just think, you know, and we've kind of belabored this point, that it really doesn't serve anybody's best interest besides maybe that one player. So, like, in Khalil Tate's, you know, own scenario. Like, but really, I don't know that it serves everyone.
Is he a Heisman Trophy candidate?
Absolutely. I mean, he's one of the most dynamic players I've seen in a while in terms of the quarterback position. I might even put him up there with like a Denard Robinson, you know, running that Rich Rod offense.
The question is, though, how do you distinguish between the players that have the access to impact the coaching hires on the roster and then the guys that don't? Where's the cutoff? Where's the gradient? You know, then that would be, oh, this guy hired this coach, so he's in his pocket. The rest of us really wanted this other coach who they didn't hire. Now you're talking about a fractured locker room.
Yeah, and that's going to be huge. And again, college football is so different from, you know, the NFL or the pro game where, hey, guess what? You're getting paid. You have to do what you have to do. But in the college game, you've got to have more of that cohesive team. And, you know, certainly that would fracture it, because if you're competing against one of these players, now granted, it's probably going to be a Heisman Trophy candidate or, you know, a big time player that's going to be affecting this. But still, you know, if you're competing, you know that you don't have a chance. That might lead to other players deciding to transfer and leave the program as well.
Yeah, the other thing it's important to recognize, too, between the NFL and the college game is the sheer size of the rosters. An NFL roster is almost half the size of a Division I college roster. So you're talking about the ability to have various cliques fester within a college roster. I mean, that could manifest three or four different types of groups.
Absolutely.
We're doing this podcast in the shadows of Big Ten Media Day this week in Chicago, an annual gathering of journalists, talking heads, Big Ten coaches. And day two of Big Ten Media Day seemed to be centered around two kind of distinguishable themes. Coach Harbaugh at Michigan being Coach Harbaugh, dressed up as the ghost of Bo Schembechler at a podium, and Scott Frost being cast as an overconfident, not quite ready yet, arrogant, first-time, big-time head coach.
Was Coach Harbaugh, did he have milk on the podium with him?
I don't know what he had.
Diet Pepsi.
But we'll stick with Harbaugh. We'll start with Harbaugh. His record against top 10 teams and his record against the heavy hitters in the Big Ten East leaves a lot to be desired. And he was reminded of those two things by the assembled media early on in the press conference. And he had some prepared answers, essentially saying like a phrase that was, improved performance leads to winning, leads to championships. So whenever a difficult question was thrown his way, he had this prepared, packaged answer that, instead of actually answering the journalist's question, which is a fair question to ask going into year four of the Harbaugh experiment, So I'll ask you, Cody, is it, you've been an observer of Harbaugh over the years as a 49ers fan. Is it fair to expect Harbaugh to act differently, or is this the modus operandi that you've seen and come to know about Harbaugh?
I would say more than just an observer.
Well, here's the thing. I think he should get credit. I mean, it's not like he's Drew Rosenhaus saying, next question. At least he, put a little thought into it. But beside that, this is just Jim. I mean, it's coming out now because he's struggling, relatively speaking. I think that's what's really, why people are making a big deal out of it. Certainly there would be times when he was winning, he'd be a little bit more gregarious. He'd be talking about, Winston Churchill quotes and, all these, his catchphrases, Freddy P. Soft, all that stuff. And, everybody's happier when they're winning. But I think that this has been Jim Harbaugh from the Stanford days. It's been Jim Harbaugh from the San Francisco 49ers days. Oftentimes, as soon as they would ask him any kind of question that remotely had anything to do with a route or anything, he would say, that scheme, I don't talk about scheme. Then they ask him about injuries. Yeah, he's working through something. He's got an ankle. Yeah, of course he has an ankle. He wouldn't be able to play football without an ankle. or if he answered a question one time, somebody asked him a different version of it or something, he'd say, that's plowed ground. That's plowed ground, already went over it. We're not going there again.
So Trent Baalke was correct back in the day?
No, it's not just Trent Baalke. I mean, even at Stanford, he had worn people thin, when he demanded his own bathroom, in Stanford. Again, he's a great coach, but I think there were a lot of people that were happy to see him move on to the NFL. And certainly at San Francisco, people were happy to see him go. Now, obviously, they regretted it in terms of the results that followed were not at all what they expected. But Jim Harbaugh is a complicated individual. He's not an easy person to get along with. He's said that. He's on the record as saying, when I was a kid, it was great that we moved around because most of the kids didn't like me by year two or year three. So we were moving because my dad was a coach, and that really worked out well for me. John, he had friends. He was a little bit more personable. So I think this is just Jim Harbaugh being Jim Harbaugh. I think sometimes, and you see it, you watch the All or Nothing about Michigan, and you see he's kind of quirky. He's kind of got, he's definitely, his socialization is a little different. He's got some awkwardness to him at times, and I think that, sometimes that plays out on that grand scale. But, now that he's not the guy that's just thumping everybody, he can't, go away from everything and, avoid all these questions, and people want answers and people are demanding answers. I think he's going to have a much better year this year, but, still, that's just Harbaugh being Harbaugh.
If he asks the rhetorical question to his players, who's got it better than us?
Urban Meyer.
His players answer Michigan, Wisconsin, Penn State, Ohio State, if they all answer their opponents, wonder what his response would be. I don't know if that question's being asked as much anymore. Michigan State's beat them. Iowa's beaten them. A lot of teams have beaten them. So,
but, hey, he's the quarterback guru, the offensive guru. They can't score points. They can't develop quarterbacks. I mean, granted, he did a lot with Rudock, but since then their offense has been very, very lackluster, and it's really been their Achilles heel.
Okay, question for you. We're still on Harbaugh. We're still on Michigan. It's an exciting topic for some people. Transfer quarterback coming from Ole Miss. Will the Michigan Wolverines deviate drastically and embrace some spread concepts, or will it look a lot similar to the kind of retro-style offensive scheme that you saw John O'Korn and the other individuals battling through, slogging through, averaging, 17 points a game? Will they open it up, or is it going to be more of the same?
Well, as a Michigan fan, you'd like to think that Jim's going to open it up and show us what he really knows offensively. And, they kind of – him and Roman tried to do that when Kaepernick was coming into his, his second year starting there, and that didn't work out so well. But nothing to me says that – Jim Harbaugh is going to deviate drastically from his philosophy. He's, you know, always stated that his philosophy was to really pump up the defense and give the defense great positioning, you know, have great special teams, have great defense, and have the offense not turn it over, have the offense put the defense in favorable positions. You know, for an offensive guy, he certainly feels like the best way to win is by really pumping up the defense and giving your special teams great opportunities. So I don't think he really will. I mean, look at some of those guys. What has Pep Hamilton done besides, you know, the Harbaugh style of offense? What has, you know, I mean, again, maybe Werner, the offensive line coach from Ohio State, from Minnesota, maybe he'll bring some different looks there, you know, maybe bring some of that Ohio State stuff. You know, Jim McElwain, you know, gosh, his offense is his offense was actually worse than Michigan's last year. I mean, when they went head to head, you know, Shea Patterson, great dual threat quarterback prospect, but I don't see Jim really doing that. I think Jim's going to conform. I mean, when they looked at Peyton Manning when he was with the Niners, they were telling Peyton Manning, hey, you're going to run our offense instead of the Peyton Manning offense. And, you know, obviously Peyton Manning worked out well with the Broncos.
A second Big Ten quarterback, although when he was there he wasn't in the Big Ten, that's leading his alma mater, Scott Frost. Scott Frost, in some circles, being criticized or people wondering aloud about his level of confidence and or arrogance. How is Scott Frost supposed to act? Is he supposed to kind of take a backseat to Urban Meyer, Harbaugh? Or is Scott Frost at Big Ten Media Day really talking to his future recruits and talking to his locker room and saying, Nebraska football is back?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't be Scott Frost and tucking your tail between your legs in the first instance. I mean, Scott Frost is there to build the Nebraska brand back, get Big Red going. And, you know, he's a guy that throughout his life, he's been very successful. I mean, he's won a national championship as a player. He's been a part of those great offenses at Oregon. He's been an undefeated coach last year at UCF. I mean, and again, they claim themselves to be national champions. And now he's at his alma mater. He's got to definitely, pump this up. You know, what do you expect? Do you think he's not going to be confident? Do you want him to be timid? No, that doesn't sell to recruits. That's not a leader, you know, on a big time scale. So it's like, well, you can't be too confident. You can't be too timid. And it's really just kind of depending on how people want to look at it. I think that he's taking the right approach.
Well, they let Mike Riley go. One of the nicest coaches, nice guy. They didn't hire Scott Frost to be Mike Riley 2.0. You know, so you tend to think that Frost's comments today at Media Day were calculated, like most of these smart guys are. It's their forum for the world or for the nation outside of just being in Nebraska. So interesting. The media days are quickly forgotten, but it's an interesting fodder for us to sit around and discuss.
Who's got it better than us?
A lot of people.
Thanks again for listening to the Poolside Genius podcast. Don't miss out on spending time poolside, so subscribe using iTunes, Stitcher, or any other major podcast platforms. While you are subscribing, we appreciate any feedback and 5-star reviews.
Remember, when you're poolside, always dive in the deep end.
Splash.